And on Thursday the 6th with Redemption Trail, Britta Sjorgen's film.
That is fascinating to me, too, just from the picture alone of, I'm blanking on the name, Marcia Gay...
Hamilton.
Hamilton, thank you.
Lisa Gay Hamilton.
Lisa Gay Hamilton. And, you know, it tells a little bit about the plot of that.
It's really about two women that come from very different sides of the track and have experienced some bad things and meet up in a very strange way and sort of are there for each other, to support each other and get each other through some rough times.
And that's a screening at the opening Thursday, March 6th.
That's correct. We start at 7:15.
7:15, yeah. And it's all at the Hollywood Theater.
It is.
And I also just was wondering, you mentioned that to me before we started the show, that there were about 100 film festivals or so in Portland alone.
Yeah, I've recently moved a few months ago to Portland, and when we were doing our research about all the fantastic things that are here, I read somewhere that there are 100 film festivals. That runs
it's
the gamut.
It's such a film town, isn't it?
Yeah, it runs the gamut from really tiny film festivals that, you know, maybe showed a couple of films to something like Portland International, which screens hundreds of films for several weeks, you know, to our film festival. So.
And yet, nationally, this is one of 7 women film festivals in the country? I think I read that.
Yeah, that could be. I don't know the actual number. But yeah, it is just a handful of films or film festivals.
Which is surprising to me that there aren't more women's film festivals. But
film festivals are so niche. You know, every film festival has something very particular about it. The hope is that one day we don't have to worry about that anymore.
Yeah.
You know, it's a film festival for filmmakers. It doesn't matter if they're men or women. I mean,
maybe it's just a way to curate it, though.
Yeah.
You know, because there is so many.
Yeah.
There are so many filmmakers. And it seems like there are more and more, actually.
I mean, the access to filmmaking is so easy nowadays.
Yeah, and the equipment's a lot less expensive now. So
right.
I'd like to bring Kimberly Warner, filmmaker, into this conversation. First, though, I want to play a little music from your film, 9, and that's composed by Mark Orton. So it begins with a bell. It's beautiful. You know, I had the chance to see it and to screen it, and I just was struck by a number of things. First off, it's about a ballerina and a young ballerina, and so, of course, you know, the arts and just the fascination with ballet, and also just how it's beautifully shot. It's just every single frame is almost like a great photographic spread in some national magazine. It's just beautiful. So where did the idea of 9 come from? Do you have a connection to ballet?
Oh, yes.
A personal connection?
Yes, it came from 18 years of ballet training. I started when I was 6 years old.
You have really good posture. I noticed that right away.
Yes, it's in my blood. I grew up in Wisconsin, and in a small dance school there. I started, like I said, when I was 6 years old, and I danced all the way through the age of 18 in this small town. And she was a Russian ballet instructor, and very strict and very committed to having her dancers excel through their bodies and through their personal expression. And so it was a beautiful discipline for me to have. And I always say I wouldn't be able to make films if I hadn't had that discipline as a dancer. It was also psychologically really challenging.
Well, now let's talk about that, because we heard some beautiful music, but then just now there was these somber tones, and it changes, isn't it? So tell us about this little girl and this image of the little girl.
So this young woman is right on the edge, and actually in real life too. She was 12 when we started filming. She turned 13 over the summer. So she's right on that beautiful edge and that tension of innocence and experience. And her curiosity and her love of the magical world is, she's the center of the universe when the film begins. And she makes things happen in her magical way, or at least she believes she does. And then she begins to encounter some of the realities of the universe that aren't maybe so perfect. And so she has to really, like a ballerina, embrace those imperfections. And there are other...
Well, I don't want to spoil it, but I do know, you know, having taken ballet when I was young and also just talking with a lot of ballerinas, how much pain is involved, as well as the discipline, but how much physical, actual, and it all centers around the feet, a lot of it, too. Yeah, I mean, the whole body, yes, but especially the feet, because the young woman, she's right on the cusp of going point on point, right, where she has to stand on her toes. So to me, that's probably the most painful things that you could do in ballet. So the two, there are two main actresses in the film, and one is the young 12-year-old that you had spoken of, on the cusp of becoming a woman, right, and really a full-force ballerina. And then there's another one, another actress who is also is a dancer in the film, and she's quite memorable, and she's the older woman. So tell us about her.
Well, that's my mother, and I wanted to portray, it's sort of the maiden mother and crone, and my mother is representing the crone in this film, and I wanted someone who could carry the wisdom of having gone through those different stages and could embrace that almost, she's beyond duality now. She's gone to that place where there's light, there's dark, there's perfection, there's imperfection, there's chaos, there's order, and she's embraced it all. And yet, you see that she also has gone through the sacrifice and the initiation.
And we won't give the spoiler what that sacrifice would be, but she does, I mean, to me, here's the dancer, you know? And I think she was quite lovely, you know, in it too.
She was wonderful.
So, I would recommend it. I mean, it's a 16-minute film, but honestly, how long did that take you to make?
It took a year. Yeah. I started writing it in January. I started writing it a year prior, but the script was done last January. And I began producing, doing pre-production and starting filming in June, ending in August. And the final edit was done, well, actually the final edit was done about 5 days ago. So I cut 2 minutes out of it.
It's never done until
never
you're done with it, right?
Oh, this is all about the work, imperfection,
the work
right?
can never be done. So I just was really drawn to it before I even knew you were going to be on the show. So
I had screened it
earlier. Nine, highly recommend it. If you love ballet, if you love beautiful films, and also with a very deep message to it. And I don't want to say it's sort of black swanish, but I mean, there's some elements of the pain and suffering that you go through in ballet. Nine by Kimberly Warner is playing at noon in the Animation Experimental Shorts program, and that's at the Hollywood Theater. You're listening to Stage and Studio. We've been talking with Portland, talking about Portland, Oregon Women's Film Festival, PowFest, and Christine Autrand Mitchell of PowFest is here, and also Kimberly Warner. And the festival runs March 6th through the 9th at the Hollywood Theater, and you can see the complete schedule at powfest.org, and you can also go to stageandstudio.org, where I have a link to all that.
It's PowFest.com.
Oh, PowFest.com. Yes. Thank you so much. Well, I have a link to PowFest.com. And closing the PowFest on Sunday, March 9th, also at 7 p.m., is a retrospective of award-winning Portland filmmaker Joanna Priestley. And she is joining us via phone right now. Hello, Joanna.
Hi, Dee May. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Say, I see your new film is in the festival, too. May
is
May.
It? Oh, thank you for mentioning that. I wasn't going to, but thank you so much. I think it's quite a thrill, actually, to be in this festival. I just want to say it on a personal level. Joanna, you created 27 animated films shown all over the world, and your themes have similar kind of similarities to it. You want to, you know, what have been the central themes of your animated films?
Oh, my God.
I mean, they seem to be varied, but they're all very internal and personal, too.
You know, I think I love what I do so much. I'm, like, super passionate about it. I love animating, and I think that joy and passion comes out through the films. I think that's one link, because one of my big influences was Norman McLaren, the great Canadian filmmaker, and he did all different kinds of experiments in his work, and that's what I've done. So, you know, on the surface, there it covers this huge variety of all different techniques. Some are narrative, and recently the work is mostly abstract, but I think that sort of underlying joy and passion shows up in all of them.
I think Split Enz is the most abstract that I've seen lately. And you mentioned that you're moving, you know, you've been moving more abstract. I had a chance to see it too. And we used some of the music. I don't know if you heard the show at the beginning, but it's very mesmerizing. It's almost hypnotic.
Thank you.
Oh, that's good. Okay.
That's a great thing. You know, I have a background as a painter and a printmaker, and I've just gone in that direction. I started, my first abstract film was let me think, I think 1985. I was at CalArts, so I've been working abstraction since then. But lately, I'd say in the past 8 years, it's become a deep, abiding passion. And once you sort of immerse yourself in that world where anything's possible and you're sort of freed from working with plot and narrative, it's such a joy. It's so much fun.
It gives you more freedom then, sounds like.
It's completely liberating.
So what, of all your films, I mean, you've got 27 of them, probably more.
No, that's it. That's
it. Okay. So how many of those are
Actually,
you going to
have? Actually, that includes one app.
Oh.
One iOS app, yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
But I didn't know where to put that, so I just put it in the filmography.
There you go. So how I guess, which one of these are you going to highlight during your special retrospective?
You know, I have no idea.
Uh-oh. This is so Christine doesn't want to hear this.
Because Tara Johnson-Mettinger, the fabulous gal that runs the show, she and another curator are putting together the program, and I have no idea what they're going to show. It's going to be shocking for me, I think.
I guess Christine raised her hand, so that must be her.
We're working on that, Joanna.
I'm very excited. It's a lot of work to do that. You really have to study someone's work, and that's a lot of films to look at and decide on what to include. So I think that's why most of the time when I do shows, because I do shows at museums and cinematheques around the world, and, you know, they just ask me to send them a list.
Well,
so this is very special that they're taking the time to sort of curate a program.
Well, while we have you two here together, I was just wondering, Christine, why did you want to do this retrospective of Joanna? I mean, I know why, but just tell us what
She's
was the
fantastic.
Impetus.
Fantastic. I mean, her work... You know, it's not just the abstract stuff that we've been talking about, but there are some fascinating films about sort of biographies, really, about, I think one of them was two gals. One of them was a prison guard. There are just amazing personal stories. Joanna just cuts herself open, basically, and just lays herself out and shares herself with us. And that is amazing to watch, to hear, you know, different stages of life that you go through. And it's absolutely fascinating. I've so enjoyed watching all her films. So it's been a pleasure.
And there's a sense of fun to your work, Joanna. Like, I'm thinking last year with Dear Pluto, you know, when that came out. And that was a lot of fun. And I, you know, I love astronomy, so I really enjoyed that one, too.
I've always wanted to do a space film.
Yeah. Well, you did one.
A great poem, a slam poem by the great slam poet from Manhattan, Taylor Mauli. It was incredible working with him. I get to work with these amazing people. And the person that does my sound, Seth Norman, he's like, I don't know what, 28, and I met him at a bar, and it's just a genius, you know, composer, sound designer.
Well,
I've had really good luck with collaborators.
Well, it all works for you, and it all works together. And your newest film, again, a shout out, Split Enz. What's ahead for you after this?
You know, I did this artist residency in the Yukon, like right next to the Arctic Circle in the winter, in Dawson City, Yukon. And I started experimenting with Native American imagery, but it never really resolved into a film. And meanwhile, I was working on another film, and that never resolved, which is very unusual in animation, and it's kind of depressing when things don't quite work out, because you have to set stuff aside, and it's a lot of work. But at some point, I thought, I'm going to mash these two films together. So I did, and it's become a much longer project.
So you're going and kind of getting the loose ends of some of the other ones together?
Well, I just sort of mashed them together.
Yeah.
I ended up with this unusual palette. It's red, white, blue, and yellow.
Oh, okay.
I know.
Well,
unusual.
Sounds great. It sounds great. Portland filmmaker Joanna Priestley, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Via phone.
Thank you.
And looking forward to your retrospective, which is happening March 9th at 7 p.m. That's a Sunday at the Hollywood Theater for the Portland, Oregon Women Film Festival. So
looking
great to have you
to
here.
May.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I'd love for you to see it. This is Stage and Studio, and we're talking about the POW Fest. If you want to hear this interview again, visit stageandstudio.org, and you can also go to powfest.com and see a full schedule of the whole event, March 6th through the 9th. Christine, in the time remaining, tell us about... you know, you've got your finger on something here.
Well,
it looks
I just wanted
like
to say that your film is going to be showing on Friday
yeah, stop,
at 6:45.
But tell us about the film after.
Well,
it starts off. It's just a little short. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we've got some absolutely fantastic films. I think we can pretty much get every flavor, whatever you like. I think there's something for you. We have quirky stories. We have films about art, Spring and Arnaud, The Healing Power of Art, I Am Sarah Maple. We have drama, La Vallée des Larmes, also known as The Valley of Tears. Oh my gosh, my French is horrible. We have a really fascinating documentary called My Long Neck, which is running on Sunday at 12:30. Our opening night with Redemption Trail, of course. We have a world premiere, Where the Darkness Has to Run, about spiritualism, Westerners in India, which is absolutely fascinating. A gal from the UK named Yolanda Barker, that's her film. And she'll be here. The fascinating part is, you know, we have probably about 40 or so films being accompanied by their filmmakers.
And they get to talk. Like,
and
oh, get to talk
yes,
before
we get,
or after.
Exactly. Yeah. You get a Q&A with them. There are plenty of opportunities to meet with the filmmakers. We have happy hours and closing night reception and opening party at Velo Cult, which you can get with your ticket for Redemption Trail. So there are lots of opportunities. We have a director's panel on Saturday at noon where we're talking about Beyond Gender, which is right up our alley. And
there's the Girls POW Fest,
absolutely.
Too. Tell us about that.
Yes. Tara has launched this amazing mentoring program called POW Girls. And basically, we're putting together six girls that get to do a film project. They're being mentored and by Portland Community Media. And they get to do a program over a couple of days and show that and be there at the premiere.
That's so great.
With a little mixer afterwards, a little youth mixer afterwards.
A great opportunity. And Kimberly, in the time remaining, what's ahead for you after 9? What's your next big deal?
My next big deal. Well, I have a stack of books next to my bed right now. And I checked them all out from Powell's and Amazon. And I'm researching witchcraft in southern Germany.
Really?
And I want, there's a story somewhere in there about seven generations of a spell. And I want it to be a little bit of historical fiction, but a little bit of fantasy, because I can't get away from
fantasy.
What
are the books? I'm just, now that I'm curious about the stack of books that you want to get to. Is it in relation to this film?
Oh, yeah, they're all on witchcraft.
They're all on witchcraft? Mm-hmm. Are they all fiction, nonfiction?
No, there's one that's a graphic novel. Most of them are just history, trying to understand a little bit of what happened in Europe prior to Salem. I mean, we always talk about Salem, but that was such a short period of our history. And then there was also this longer stretch of 500 to 1,000 years of witchcraft.
Fascinating.
And so
I love
we'll
that.
See. It might take me years to write that.
keep me posted. I'm fascinated already. And since you guys have mentioned it, yes, my film, May May, it's edited. I just want to mention the editor is T. Howard, and she's an amazing editor. And that plays March 7th at 6:45. And it's right before the Valley of Tears. And I'm not going to go into the French people, but it has a French title. And people have heard my half-hour radio program, May May. They could be interested in seeing it turned into a film. So that's sort of my next big deal. And to see the PAL Fest schedule, visit, I'll feature the whole half hour. That's what I do. So to see the PAL Fest full schedule, visit palfest.com or visit stationstudio.org, where you can also hear this interview later today. Christine Autran Mitchell of PAL Fest, thank you so much for coming here.
What a pleasure. Thank you.
And filmmaker Kimberly Warner.
This has been
great
wonderful.
Great to meet you. You're just fascinating. So I'm just, I want to keep posted on what your next thing is and the witchcraft. It's going to be, I'm there. Thanks for visiting with us today. So kudos to both of you. Up next, Let 100 Flowers Bloom was an award-winning playwright by award-winning play by playwright David Zelnick, and it was his first full-length play, and it received the 2001 Off-Off-Broadway Review Award for Best Play, and it's been seen in London and New York. But you know what? This is receiving its first West Coast premiere at Defunct Theater through March 22nd, and the play is a love story. It's set in 1996 during the time of the creation of the antiretroviral therapy treatment for HIV-positive patients. Here, playwright David Zelnick talks about his first play, Let 100 Flowers Bloom.
So I started thinking about this play, Let 100 Flowers Bloom, right around 96, 97, when the protease inhibitors started coming out. And for those of you who don't remember, they radically upended how people were thinking about HIV and AIDS at the time. I remember I came to New York in 89, and New York was a very angry place then. The gay community was furious, and it was the ACT UP years. And I was a little bit too young to participate in that. And when I became more aware of the way AIDS was allowed to happen and AIDS was working within the city and the country, it actually was the mid-90s, and New York was a very depressed place. And there was a great deal of sadness and depression and the sense that nothing was ever going to help. We were all going to die. I definitely had that fear myself. Everyone was going to get HIV and we were all going to die. And so I remember when those drugs came out and there was this burst of disbelief and joy and amazement that people might actually get better. People might actually, if not be cured, it might be livable. It just, it was so dramatic, and it was so moving and strange and terrifying. In some ways, that is the genesis of the play, but a few different things came together that informed the play. One thing was I was day jobbing at Pfizer, and I sort of knew that Viagra was coming. And so while there were all these other pills that were very much about, you know, helping people with HIV live, there were these conversations with these old men talking about erections and that it was going to change the world on that level. And they were even talking about how disabled guys might be a really huge thing for them. And so that felt really thrilling. When I started writing scenes, most of my friends thought I was writing sci-fi, that they had no idea this drug was coming. And then the final piece of the puzzle is I was really close friends with a guy who was disabled, and another close friend of mine was starting to do work with quadriplegics and paraplegics at a summer camp. So all of a sudden, I was forced to wrestle with questions of how you live your life if you're disabled in more practical ways and in more, you know, blooded, heated ways than maybe I had before. And so all that came together in this sense of telling a love story that where you saw people transforming through drugs, but also through what those drugs allowed people. And I guess the final thing is I'm a history buff, so I was also reading about Chairman Mao at the time. And I read a book called The Private Life of Chairman Mao, written by his doctor. And it was a fascinating read. And somehow that, you know, made it all come together in this idea of epic changing history that also affects the very intimate life of the body and how people live and change.
That was playwright David Zelnick talking at Defunct Theater, and was recorded by Andrew Klaus. Let 100 Flowers Bloom continues through March 22nd at Defunct in the Backdoor Theater behind the Common Grounds Coffee Shop at 4319 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard. For more info, visit defuncttheater.org or stageandstudio.org, where I have a link to that site. That's it for Stage and Studio. Thanks to engineer Janet Anderson. I'll have this show online later today at stageandstudio.org, as well as a podcast on iTunes. Also like us on facebook.com/stage_studio, or tweet me at @stage_studio. Till next time, I'm Dee Mae Roberts. We're going out with more music by Seth Norman from Joanna Priestley's film Split Ends.
You're tuned to KBOO Portland 90.7. Up next is Art Focus with host Ava Lake. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Aladdin Theater, presenting The Musical Box, a Peter Gabriel authorized recreation of Genesis, Thursday, February 27th. Tickets and information for The Musical Box, February 27th at aladdin-theater.com.
Andy Warhol, let's just scream, hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen, can't tell them apart at all. Andy Warhol, let's just scream, hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen, can't tell them apart at all.
Hello, everybody. Thanks so much for listening to Art Focus. My name is Ava Lake. I've been gone for a couple of weeks, and just wanted to mention, did you see Oregon Art Beat? Did any of you people see OPB Oregon Art Beat? That's just something I want to put in your ear. I won't tell you what it was. You'll just have to go and Google and find out. I have with me today two children. They are siblings, and they are kids of an important artist that lived here in Portland, Oregon. His name was Leonard Ruder. And he was the subject of an exhibition that was at the Merrillhurst Art Gym. He also had an exhibition at Ogden Gallery. He had works in the Portland Art Museum too, yes?
Yes.
Yes. So I have with me today Ryan Ruder and Rhea Ruder Sleeman. And from what I understand, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Ava.
Thanks for having us, Ava.
Yeah. So I think you guys have an interesting story because you watched this man make work for many years, right? And also be sort of in and out of the Portland art community at that time, yes?
Correct.
And when you mean, when we talk about in and out, we're talking about like sometimes really being involved and then other times just making work and not being involved. Am I right about this?
Well, I think when he came to Portland in the late 40s, very late 40s, early 50s, he was really involved.
Uh-huh.
Because he'd just gotten out of school. He went to Cranbrook.
Uh-huh.
And he'd also been in this show that traveled around. It was in Boston, and it went around the country. And so I think he was kind of maybe like a rising star at that
rising
time.
Star. Was it called Six Painters, that
Six
show?
Painters, yeah.
Okay.
And then he came to Portland and was part of the very small community that was in Portland at that time. He knew all the artists at that time. He and my mother, who came out from Detroit, my dad was from Detroit. He came, they lived downtown, they knew everybody that was an artist at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And then, as he had children, my sister Rhea and me and my brother, then he wasn't selling a lot of stuff. And we had to move out to where he worked because then he became a janitor. We had to move to the suburbs.
We moved to suburbia, basically.
Let's backtrack here a little bit then. So what was his job when he first came here?
Well, he came here and he did various things. He did work at a can company making tin cans.
Wow. I think he worked as a mail carrier for about a week.
What happened there? Who knows?
Dogs, I think.
Yeah, dogs.
Yes. Yes. So Leonard Ruder, would you say that your dad had the temperament of an artist? I mean, was he a typical dad? I mean, was it Leaver to Beaver or what was it?
No. Okay. He was definitely had the temperament of an artist. I mean, so much so that he couldn't do anything but that, I would say.
Although,
well, that's not entirely true.
Yeah.
Because he loved his kids and his wife.
So I would say that we had, you know, some of the typical childhood experiences, but mm-hmm. always had that other kind of element of him introducing us to lots of other things, including, you know, his love for painting, photography, the arts.
Yes.
He was we experienced going to peace rallies. Uh-huh.
He was a beatnik originally.
Really?
Yeah.
My mom and dad and a friend of his and his wife, they lived downtown in a commercial space. They weren't squatters, they paid. Uh-huh. It was like a real bohemian thing.
Yeah.
This was 52, 53. I was born in 53.
Uh-huh.
My sister comes like a little, she's born in 60, right?
So one Correct. Of these old buildings that's like down on
it's,
like the
it's
southwest?
It's smashed down because it's
on like first and second and third. When all that urban renewal happened.
Yeah.
And they were,
right.
Been, yes.
They lived, I think, above the Elephant Castle, if you remember that.
I do.
Old fish and chips place.
Wow. So that's where they were. So, and for how long?
Well, they're
like Portland history here.
They're like 3 years until I think I was born. Uh-huh. And then I think the other couple, he was an artist too. They had a child. Then they had to move to a more child-friendly place. We lived then by Shattuck Grade School, which is now Shattuck Hall of Portland State University.
So when he got here, he, as you said, he you know, hung out and met a lot of artists and must have introduced you to a lot of people. Who did he know here? Who were the artists that he was hanging out with during all that time?
Gosh, well, the experience that Ryan talked about in the loft, he actually shared the loft with Hank Cowart.
Uh-huh.
And some other friends, Claude McGraw, Jim Hibbard, and part of our my memories, probably Ryan's memories too, were
gathering. Louis Bunce.
And we would gather.